Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. I am your host, Batabile Ntombeni, couples mediator and negotiation coach, and today my guest is Tara Fischler, also a mediator. We are going to talk about training young mediators. You're listening to Michelle Webb, and the piece she's playing is called Beeswax. It's from her album, DC Istanbul. Sit back and listen and enjoy. We'll be back with you in just a moment so that Tara can tell you her story. Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation.
To have you here,
a little bit of figuring this out with my guest Tara Fischler in her home in New Rochelle, and we are happy to be here, and I'm glad to be here. She has been so gracious and opened her home to me, and one of the things I wanted to do for the show is to go where my guests are and sort of interview them or have a conversation. Really, it's not an interview. We would just want to have a chat in a place where you feel comfortable. So, Tara, thank you so much and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm very happy to have you, and I'm really thrilled to be on your show.
Wonderful. Well, the show is about talking with mediators and people who are involved in alternative dispute resolution about their stories, how they got into the profession, what drives them, why they do what they do. I know that one of the things that you do most is to work with children, and it's something that you've been doing for quite a bit of your career and of your life, all the way back in college. Tell me a bit about how you got started and what inspired you to want to work with children.
Sure. Well, I have pretty much always wanted to work with children. I always did love children. And when I was in college, I went to SUNY Brockport, and I designed my own major in children's studies. And what that enabled me to do is to put together different kinds of courses in psychology, child welfare, different types of things, education, and really learn all different aspects of children. I even volunteered in a daycare center then and different kind of things like that. And then after college, I said, well, I either want to go to social work school, get my MSW, or go to law school. And I figured I'd make more money with a law degree, even though I didn't plan to practice even then, even from the very beginning. And so I went to Franklin Pierce Law Center, which is now UNH Law, and I worked in public interest and then basically got trained to be a parent-child mediator back in 1992. So I've been at this now for about 20 years.
Yeah. Although, you know, I remember 1992 so well, I'm not happy about this.
You don't show it. It's good.
Well, okay, neither do you.
Thank you.
But why kids? Is there something that happened in your growing up that inspired you to want to work with kids?
Well, I had a pretty good childhood overall, and I used to be active in a youth group, and I just really liked to be able to learn from children as much as I could teach children. I always look at that as a two-way street. I love to teach and really see what kind of things the children teach me, what they bring. You know, when I teach them, you know, mediation or conflict resolution, they have such an interesting opinion or way that they see the activities that I do. And as many years as I'm doing it, there's always something that's new that they bring.
Right, right.
So that's what I enjoy.
I agree with you. You know, there are folks who would see what you do as being really special in the sense that it's something that they're not able to do, which is to work with kids. I think it takes a particular kind of mindset, a particular kind of confidence, and a particular kind of openness to doing things in creative ways. You know, kids especially who haven't gone through, I guess by the time high school is when the creativity has perhaps been, you know, beaten out of them.
Sometimes that's true. And I have worked with all ages from preschool through graduate school. I work with adults and parents as well, different capacities, administrators and so on. You know, the past several years I've been working with elementary school, training primarily third, fourth, and fifth graders in mediation to be peer mediators. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if all of your audience knows exactly what that is, but basically it's teaching kids how to help other kids solve problems or solve conflicts, as we say. So when they'll be out on the playground and different schools, they'll either wear a special shirt or they'll have a vest or they'll have some kind of way of identifying the peer mediators that are on duty. And they'll be looking around to see if there's any kind of conflicts going on or brewing, kids who are feeling left out, kids who are fighting. And one of the things that we tell both the mediators and the parents and the administrators is, you know, we don't have the idea to step into the middle of the conflict. Recently, safety is the top priority. There's always an adult that is in the room when they are mediating, and we use a co-mediation facilitated model. What I primarily teach.
What does that mean?
So that means that there's always two mediators, two young people. There's always an adult in the room, which is more a safety measure, just to get a hand or to help them out if they get stuck. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. I think my allergies must be catching.
Could be. And so in a facilitative model, what we're doing is we're teaching them to ask open-ended questions. Mm-hmm. We're teaching them to paraphrase in a neutral way. And there are obviously many other types of mediation. And one of the nice things is, having been in the field so long and gone to different types of trainings myself, I'm familiar with other types of training, transformative and evaluative and so on. And I will teach the kids where this type of mediation falls in that spectrum, so that they know that they're learning a particular way of doing this.
Okay.
And as they get older, if they decide they want to continue to practice mediation in some method, they can learn that, well, you know, in transformative, they do it a different way, and in evaluative, it would be a different way. And we teach them sort of the spectrum of solving conflict, that, you know, the best thing is certainly if you and I are having a conflict, that we could work. But sometimes we can't.
Uh-huh.
And so we may go to a neutral third person mediator. And if it doesn't work for any reason in mediation, whether it's in a school setting or community setting, I've done community mediation as well, then there's always other types of formats, arbitration, courts, a principal, depending, you know, some person in authority who can make a decision. So really trying to show them that mediation is a good second step when you can't figure it out yourself. And that there are always other options. You really don't lose anything that way. So,
you know what I love about what you're doing is that you are starting kids out at a time when they're being enculturated.
Yes.
When they're learning what conflict is, when they're learning what it is to interact with other people, and that they're learning that mediation is a viable, not more than viable, it's a really great way to approach conflict from the get-go. Mm-hmm. I think one of the challenges that mediators face is dealing with a public that is not really inculcated in that kind of mindset. So talk to me about what happens when you've trained peer mediators, and now it's part of the culture of the classroom or part of the culture of the school or the grade and that sort of thing. What kinds of shifts do you see?
That's a great question. You know, and it does take a while. You know, when I go into a school, I usually won't work with a school for just a year, because a year is really not enough time for it to take. It's great if you're going to do it for a year. We can teach them things about how they can help themselves, how they can help other people. But really, it's a culture sees this as a viable way. You know, mediators are always really excited. That's not the problem. You know, we take applications and there's usually more people that want to be trained than we can train at one time.
So even at that age when they're not sure what mediation is, they're raring to go for it?
Well, usually the way we introduce it, the way I introduce it in a school, is we usually do either an assembly presentation or classroom presentation and we'll stage a conflict. The first year I'm in a school is usually the most interesting because I'll stage it with the adults. So we'll have the adults pretend to start fighting, and the kids are just shocked that that adults would be really fighting. And in fact, one of my schools that's now a long-term school, in the beginning, we had staged this conflict between two teachers, and they were fighting over borrowing a book. You know, we set this thing up, and only, you know, I knew it, and the liaison for the school knew it. And in walks the assistant principal, who did not know that we had set this up. And he's trying to get the teacher's attention, and he's trying to like, no, you can't be fighting in front of the kids. What are you doing? This is totally. And we had to have somebody kind of say, hey, no, it's cool. Shh. But the kids had rapt attention. They were watching what went on, and they asked the two teachers who were fighting, in quotes, to come up, and I demonstrated mediation and demonstrated how they would work out the conflict. And then after that, we asked who wants to be trained to be a mediator. And at that point, there's
like
a lot of interest.
It's
definitely effective. I mean, the children need to understand it is a responsibility. They are giving up some of their playtime when they're on duty. They do have to come for generally 3 days of training, 3 full days. And they have to make up their classwork and all that kind of stuff. So it is a commitment, and we do explain that pretty thoroughly. They usually have to write an essay or get a recommendation or some combination. But the kids that we get, virtually all of them want to continue. And there's always a few who decide, no, I want to play. And you know, but most of them, when they see the training, everything that we do is very experiential. There are lots of games. There's lots of stories, particularly, you know, with the younger grades. Although really at all levels, we do an activity. We're working in my office today.
Yeah.
But I have all kinds of materials that are just great fun activities. And the kids really enjoy it. They'll ask me when I come back to the school, because that's the other thing, is my philosophy is quality training. I don't want to train good. I have actually friends who want me to only do that and not show up again, because the kids really need follow-up. They really need reinforcement of the skills and to practice and have a chance to talk about, hey, I had this case, the teacher had not talking about it, but the kid happened and the girl was not, you know, not cooperating or whatever the thing is. So they need a place to be able to say what was happening and build their skills. So we'll go back to the school on average monthly basis throughout the year to work with the kids.
Oh, this is just amazing and marvelous.
Thank you.
I do want us. You're welcome. I do want us to get back into the culture and how you what kinds of changes that you see. But starting small, you know, sort of individually. What about the kids who decide that they want to be mediators and they're growing into the role?
That's a wonderful thing to watch.
Yes,
they do, and they take that very seriously. This is their job, you know. Kids, their job is mainly to go to school, and they have to do something like where they help another person who is an asset to the school. And what I find amazing, as I said, it's usually a 3-day training. By the end of the first shift training, they're usually performing an opening statement. So they're sitting in groups of four. There's two co-mediators and two disputants doing a role play. And they're just, at this point, reading off a sheet of paper. What's the opening statement? What do I say? And yet they sit up tall. They, you know, they take it seriously. They have a serious look on their face. And afterwards, I'll process it with them as I do all the activities. And say, how did that feel? And they talk about, I felt grown up. I felt like I had a job. I felt like I was important. And they do. It helps their self-esteem, which is such a critical thing at that age in middle school, high school, all those ages, you know, that we've trained. You know, building their self-esteem is so wonderful. And then by the third day, when they're actually doing the whole thing all by themselves, you know, it's just such a transformation. And then when I start to look at, you know, particularly in the schools I've been in for multiple years, when I see them in fifth grade or whatever, you know, they just have a different persona. It goes from being rote, where they're reading off a sheet of paper, you know, practicing, to where they starting to think and apply it as an art form, where they're really starting to say, well, what question would be a good question to ask here?
You know? You have actually segued into one of the things that I was wondering about.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about, you know, they're growing into this maturity and they have this status and take on the role of being a responsible person in that sense. But the interesting is still in the art.
Yes.
Mediators, you know, folks who are not mediators who are listening, may not realize that, that if sitting here watching a mediation, the mediator may seem to be very quiet. Most of the time, you want to make sure the parties are doing a lot of the talking,
mm-hmm.
but there's a heck of a lot of stuff going on in your head. Right?
That is certainly true. You know, should I sit here? Should I? I mean, I do mediation for Westchester Human Rights Commission, and I do some arbitration, Better Business Bureau, on. But, you know, your brain is always working as to, you know, what kind of things should I say? How far should I take this? What kind of things should I do? And for kids, you know, it takes a while just developmentally for them to get there, for them to feel comfortable with the role, for them to understand that it's not I ask question one, then question two, then question three. You know, a lot of them will start there, which is okay for starting, but then you really want them to grow into that and start to understand that you have to be listening for what the other party's saying. And I teach them about, you know, finding common ground. And, oh, this person seems to be interested in an apology, you know. And the other person said something about an apology. What can you say that brings that together? You know, so really when you're training them, it's I teach them that these are tools in their toolbox. It's kind of like they have to play detective. And they have to see, you know, what are the pieces from what they're hearing that they can put together that will help the parties to move forward.
Oh, fascinating and awesome. Really awesome, because, you know, I think folks might underestimate kids' analytical skills.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of analytical skills are involved. I mean, of course, it requires an aptitude for empathy and
for
being able to see multiple sides of an issue.
Absolutely.
But then it also requires that when somebody speaks and says something, you read into what they're saying, you know, the core of what they're saying. And the core meaning of what it is, grasp that, pull it out, and put it on the table for everybody else to be able to, you know, mull over and discuss. And so we still do that as a younger.
Yes, it is. And we talk a lot about how, because a lot of what I find is there's sort of the formal mediation process that we teach them, where we sit down and we have all this stuff. And then a lot of what happens is it happens informally, you know, and I know there's a lot in the field about this, about, you know, on the street mediation and one party mediation and different kinds of things like that. And the kids seem to do that instinctively. So whereas, you know, at a particularly an elementary level, the level of the conflict is kind of minor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're fighting over a pencil, they're fighting over who gets to play, that kind of thing. But, you know, once they figure that out, it can be a kind of quick resolution. So getting them to look at that and they may not make it to a mediation room before it gets worked out. It may be enough for a mediator on duty to say, hey, can I help here? And it might happen so fast, just right at that moment.
And it gets resolved.
It generally does.
Then it, the question for me is if the learning draws in line between judging and the levels of conflict, you know, which they're not encouraged to do.
Right.
Yet knowing when they can intervene and would be welcome.
You know, this is something I've had this conversation with many classrooms and many schools, and there isn't an easy answer for that, because on the one hand, I caution them, and I really do, because the adults need to be there for everyone's safety. There's also one of the things that I teach them, you know, when kids talk about confidentiality. They basically said, what's said in this room stays in this room. That's their line. You know, that's their thing. So everybody feels like, okay, it's safe here. And that's the extent for kids. The adult actually has a bigger role in that room, in that if there was something that they heard about, a threat of harm to a child or anybody else, they would be a mandated reporter. They would have to report that. And so the part of the intake process with the adult, and this is something I try to emphasize, is they have to be able to say, you know, this is a safe place and you need to know that everything is going to be kept in that room unless I hear of a threat of harm to anyone, mm-hmm. then I would have to break that mm-hmm. confidentiality. So that's the role for the grown up. Mm-hmm. That's not a role for the kid. So the downside of the on the spot mediation for child is, you know, it could get to that point. The reality is, particularly in elementary school, I have yet to hear of a case where confidentiality has had to be broken or there's been some issue that's so significant. Because the reality is, there's already other methods in the school to handle severe conflict. One of the things that I maybe now's a good time to mention, and I do tend to mention in all of my trainings and with all of my groups of any age, really, is the difference between bullying and teasing and what can be mediated and what can't.
Uh-huh.
We actually recently saw the movie Bully. Quite a movie.
Wow.
Very intense.
Wow. So who saw the movie?
My husband and I saw the movie.
Okay.
Because we wanted to see if it would be appropriate for any of our children. I have a 10-year-old in particular that I was looking at seeing, maybe my 13-year-old. And we've kind of decided that, no, we don't think that we thought it was intense as adults.
Right.
It's a great movie. It's a wonderful movie. And I can see once it comes out on DVD that we would show parts of it and have conversations and use it as a teaching tool.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie as a whole, we found to be
quite
too intense.
Okay.
But the concept of it is, you know, kids do get bullied. That does happen in the best school systems and the worst school systems. It just happens. And yet, as much as that is a reality, and there's lots of things in place to prevent it, you know, one of the things they say there is that we can't prevent what everybody says and does. And that's true. And part of prevention is creating the atmosphere in the school that's a welcoming atmosphere and where that's really not acceptable, and training the teachers to recognize what is really going on, because kids are subtle.
Oh, they can.
You know, there's lots of things that, you know, the best trained eye will miss. On the other hand, the vast majority of what happens in a school building is not bullying. It's teasing. And teasing needs to be dealt with, and mediation is an effective way of handling teasing. But the difference between the two is the issue of power. So the example that I give is if, you know, you and I know each other from school, and I come after you every single day, and I'm teasing you, or I'm leaving you out, or I'm snickering about you to my friends, or I might be hurting you, I might be taking something from you, those kind of things, and you feel like you can't ever say anything back to me. You're afraid of me, and every day I'm coming and targeting you. So it's repeated, negative, intentional act where there's a power imbalance. That is bullying, and that needs to be dealt with in an authoritative way. The parents need to notify school, the school needs to have a plan in place, and if that's not done satisfactorily, they need to go higher and so on. But what more often happens is you and I used to be friends, and today I don't like you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not talking to you today, and I tell my friend you're yucky or you're stupid or whatever. And you may be sad about that. But in a couple of days, we're friends again,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then a few days later, you're mad at me,
mm-hmm.
and you think I'm awful, and you tell all your friends that I'm awful, and I shouldn't, and they shouldn't play with me. But then a couple of days later, we're friends again. And this kind of goes back and forth, where there's not a power imbalance. You're not afraid of me, and I'm not afraid of you. We just like each other some days and don't like each other other days. And, you know, we may get friends involved in that, depending on the extreme there. But if there's not the power imbalance, then it's not bullying. And then you really can use mediation to create empathy. Then a skilled mediator or mediators can get the two of us in a room and talk about how it feels when we exclude each other, when we're angry with each other, when we tell our friends different things, whatever it is. And that can be really, really effective, because kids, particularly at the younger ages, but even middle school, sometimes even high school, they really do have the ability to build empathy. Sometimes even in a bullying situation, you can build empathy, but there you need a different approach. And mediation, I believe mediation is appropriate in almost every situation, but where there's a significant power imbalance, then something else needs to be in place to protect both parties.
Right, right. Great point. Great point. And I think it's really great for folks to get that insight into that fine line
mm-hmm.
between bullying and teasing, what can be mediated, what cannot be mediated.
Mm-hmm.
I'm expecting that if people are looking to show how much similarity with mediation, I want to make sure that they're understanding the terminology that we're using. I'm going to back up. You talked about different styles of mediation. We have to get to the definitions of them, but just allow people to understand that in mediation, not all mediators are the same.
Not at all. I would say pretty much every mediator has their own style, and some will hold more true to a particular style over another, and some are a little more fluid. Many mediators that I know will do what's called for in the moment. They are trained in more than one thing and will give the parties what they need when they need it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's along a continuum. In terms of what I'm teaching to the young people when I train in this facilitative model, basically the mediator is in charge of the process and the parties are in charge of the outcome. In other things like transformative, the parties are in charge of both.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one quick difference between them. So what that means is that the mediator will make an opening statement. They will welcome the parties. They will set up some ground rules so that the mediation runs smoothly. They'll make sure that everybody understands confidentiality and that kind of thing. And then they will ask open-ended questions to each party and paraphrase their response, hopefully in a neutral way, where again, like in transformative, they may not paraphrase in a neutral way. That's done in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So here we talk about helping the parties to hear the message, and that's one of the benefits of paraphrasing. And they'll kind of go back and forth where they will ask each party different open-ended questions. Can you describe what happened? Can you explain more? How did you feel when that happened? And that kind of thing. And they will draw the story out of the participants asking these open-ended questions. And then hopefully they will start to figure out what they want to do about it. Now, on an elementary level, It's a four-step process. It's pretty simple, pretty straightforward, happens relatively quickly. By the middle school level, we add another layer to that, which is identifying issues, which you are probably familiar
sure.
with. We do that as well. On elementary, there's not that many issues most of the time.
Right.
You know, she took my pencil, she won't let me play. You know, they're pretty, you know, she hit me with the ball on purpose. It's that kind of thing for the most part. In the middle school level, it starts to get a little more involved. There's, you know, loyalty and relationship issues. There's, you know, hurt feelings and trust and responsibility. And it starts to get a little more involved. And by high school, there are pretty significant enmeshed, you know, situations for the most part. It could be he took my boyfriend and, you know, that kind of, or my girlfriend or whatever the thing is. And there could be, in terms of influences of friends, is the other thing that, you know, we focus on making sure that you're getting the right parties in the room, which, again, we do as adults as well.
Yes.
You know, it can make or break a mediation
exactly.
If you don't have the decision makers there.
Right.
I find in elementary school, it's like, yeah, but I was there too, so I should come to the mediation. It's like, and the adult is usually the one who has to say, okay, but this happened between you, and so these are the two. And then part of that agreement may be, do we go back and say, because again, mediation is confidential, unless
what are we gonna say?
Something else. So how do we say, so part of the agreement may be, we agree to tell our friends it's cool. You know, and that may be the extent of it. They may get written into the agreement, and hopefully
you do written agreements.
A lot of times they do written agreements. Yeah, it's not always. Again, depends on the case, but I do teach them how to write an agreement. Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time on that, and they should have that ability.
This is awesome because you're starting them out at, you know, how old? What, 9, 10?
As young as 8. I actually had the good fortune to train my own son last year in third grade.
Uh-huh.
And now he helped train. And that's the other thing. When I get to work with school for more than 1 year, I do leadership model where I do a train the trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And the mediators who were trained the year before or 2 years before or whatever it was, helped me train the incoming group. And they talk about their change in demeanor. They're teaching, and they're really doing it, and they do such a great job. And, again, that's why peer mediation is so effective, because I'm an adult. I can't change that. I'm not a kid, you know, and I don't get the language and the movement and the stuff the same way the kids do. I can't put it the way they understand it as much as I'm around them. And, no, they hear it differently from each other. And so even in training, having the kids be able to explain it and model it, it's a wonderful thing.
But what I'm fascinated by then is you've got this cohort that has, you know, established an understanding of a certain way to approach dealing with conflicts with each
mm-hmm.
other. And so in the time that they spend together from grade to grade, when you reach a place where it is middle school, high school, mm-hmm. and things are getting more entrenched, you know, what are you seeing about what are you seeing from them in the way that they approach conflict?
Well, I'll tell you one quick thing is one day I was doing an end-year meeting with a school in the city, and I had stopped in a coffee shop before going to work. And
what meeting? I'm sorry?
I was doing an end-year meeting. We do these end-year celebrations.
Oh, end-year. Okay.
End of the year, right.
That's right.
End of
uh-huh.
year. In June, we usually do some kind of celebration,
okay.
and so we're off-site.
Yeah.
So I stopped in this coffee shop, and I was there, and I had mentioned something about, I don't know why, but it came up somehow that I was working with these mediators. And the young woman behind the counter said, "Oh, I'm a mediator too. I was trained in school."
Oh, awesome.
I'm like,
awesome.
So we're definitely seeing this sense where, and I was just reading about in the ACR, AC Resolution, they had a wonderful magazine recently mm-hmm. on where people come from, what they come in with. You
right.
know, one comes as, from a therapist background, one comes from this, you know, all these different backgrounds that
right.
we all bring, and how do we make that work? And one of the people listed in there is from this generation of, I've got nothing. I came from school. I learned this. I got my PhD or I got my master's or I got my whatever in conflict resolution. And so, and some of those people, I mean, I always find it funny when we talk about mentoring programs, which can be wonderful, but what a lot of adults don't realize is the kids may have more experience than the adults.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a kid who is a high school mediator, there's a good chance they were trained in elementary or middle school and have been mediating for 6 or 7 years by the time they're in high school.
Right.
You know, and there you have this adult who may be in the field for 5 or 10 years or whatever, and that's so.
So you're walking
each other.
I mean, it brings a whole different light to the idea of peer.
Yes, it does. It does. And really, they come in with this knowledge and this mm-hmm. experience. And those who are really serious about it, I mean, I've had a couple of different parents ask me for recommendations for their students, for their kids,
mm-hmm.
Going from elementary school to middle school. And in Manhattan, you get to choose the school and interview for it and whatever. Mm-hmm. And two of my peer mediators only wanted to go to a middle school that had a peer mediation program. That was their criteria. They wanted a school that had peer mediation. And I had to work for the Institute, and I used to run, I was the director of the mediation programs there in schools, and we ran a program called Project STOP, Schools Teaching Options for Peace. And that program was a collaboration of three agencies, and we worked in 40 middle schools every 2 years. So we had pretty much every middle school in the five boroughs that we had run peer mediation programs. Well, now funding being what it is, and it shifts. I don't know what the current percentages are of the number of schools, but it's a far cry from what it used to be. So there are, you know, for this young lady, there was one school in particular that she wanted. I think there were two that she was considering that had peer mediation programs. I find that kind of sad and unfortunate.
Sure.
And then you look at the proliferation of conflict resolution programs in colleges.
Yes.
And master's programs,
right.
There's tons of them. Now, again, we can get into the whole concept. I don't know if you want to about, well, what happens with all those people in the field? That may be another interview another time. I don't know.
This is why I'm so excited
yeah.
about the fact that you know, kids are being taught this in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they choose not to go into mediation as a profession, they're mm-hmm. familiar with it. They
yes.
have experienced it.
Yes.
They have experienced what happens. I mean, the very fact that, you know, if I'm in a school where the culture is when people are being teased to the point of feeling uncomfortable, we don't just ignore that. We talk about it.
That's right. And there's a place that the kids can go where the kids, where they feel comfortable that other kids get it.
Right.
You
right.
know?
But that is, you know, well, it's not necessarily a mind shift because you're establishing this from the get-go with young
well,
kids.
Well, it is a mind shift. Not it is for sure for the kids because they're used to going to help. We solve kids' conflicts. If I'm a teacher in a classroom
mm-hmm.
and a kid comes to me and says he took my pencil, chances are I'm going to say, well, just take another one or give it back, or, you know, I'm going to quickly solve that.
Right.
And there's a benefit to that. Teachers need to run their classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, when somebody, you know, in a lot of classrooms, we talk about creating a peace corner. And mm-hmm. one of I do training for teachers in continuing ed as well. And A number of years ago, one of my students had said in kindergarten she creates Peace Island. And in Peace Island in her classroom, any kid who's having a tough time, not getting along with himself or someone else, can go to Peace Island, and there's a squeezy ball, there's markers and paper, there's a picture of a palm tree, there's some running water, whatever, so that the child can calm themselves down and be ready to rejoin the class, as opposed to, you're going to the principal's office, or, you know, normally we're a culture where we're used to going to authority, you know, and go to your boss. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how we're taught to solve problems. You know, I'm trained as a lawyer, as you know.
Yes.
intentionally never practiced. Did pass the bar in New York and New Jersey.
Me too.
There you go.
Sorry, we have a similar story as far as that's concerned, and I'm hoping my parents are listening. She did it too.
Yeah.
I took the
bar
exam, passed it. Never went for admission. I, you know, I'm not admitted to the bar because I chose to do mediation.
There you go. See, I'm admitted. In the practice of law, I just don't have to pay their fees every year. But I mean, it's the training was good. I'm glad I learned what I learned in law school.
Right.
It helps me with arbitration more than anything else,
sure.
Really. But you know, and had I not done that, I would not have been trained as a parent-child mediator. I wouldn't have.
Sure.
And I set up a program in middle school up in New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
back then.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was a great way to get there.
Right.
But, yeah, never planned to practice.
Right, yeah.
Just like you.
I want to hang on to making sure that we
sure.
sort of wrap up on talking about getting to, you know, forming a culture, helping a culture for mediation as a go-to. We do have somebody on the line who has a question, so we're going to come to them in just a second. You know, we're talking about an issue really strong one in the mediation community about the programs that are coming up in colleges, in math programs. People are graduating, and then, you know, the question is, where are the jobs? But I'm loving what you're doing is your market.
Well, I'm creating the interest, much like those programs are. And then I do think we have more to do in terms of educating the public, which is what's going to give all these people jobs.
I
mean, I've done lots of workshops about, you know, marketing your business and strategic planning and things like that. And there's got to be a reality check. You know,
mm-hmm.
I created my own business from a base and from the interest in training,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it is, you know, the masses are not going to, right now, are not going to get jobs in this that are full-time paid positions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's unfortunate that we have, in my opinion, you know, the community centers do a wonderful job and they are a fantastic resource for many communities. But I think it's not right that the mediators are not paid at all. I mean, the number of no-shows that happen, it really devalues the service. And that's one thing that I personally don't like. I mean, if the mediators don't want to get paid for it, that's fine. But most people should get, at least in my opinion, a stipend, something, and the party should pay even $5, $10.
But people value what they know that. And we're going. The idea that you're creating a norm,
mm-hmm.
right? So that the kids who start out at 8, 9, 10 years old are growing up with an idea that you don't necessarily always have to go to authority.
Right. And part of the shift that we were talking about before, just to cap that, is for the kids to realize there's an option, but also for the adults
mm-hmm.
to see the value in the children
mm-hmm.
and to see when an adult will actually watch a mediation by the kids, they're usually amazed at how they can do this. And I don't know if you'd like me to tell a quick story about that.
Oh, sure.
I was in one of my schools. And we were coming back from break. The kids had been off for 10 days or whatever it was. And I asked, anybody want to tell me about how you used your skills over the time that you were off? Because obviously they're not doing a formal mediation or anything like that. And I had several volunteers to tell me these great stories. And one in particular told me about how she trained her friend to be a mediator. They had a play date, and she taught her how to ask open questions and how, you know, how, what a mediator does. And the next day, the two of them went to her father's office, and there were two interns, and they were fighting over how to do a particular project. And this, I think she was in fourth grade, you know, so like 9 or 10 years old. And her friend, who had trained, she taught some stuff, actually actually mediated these interns.
Fantastic.
And got them to come to a solution about how they were going to handle this thing. And the father was like, wow, you can do that? You know, like, this is a very valuable workplace skill. This
Absolutely.
Is a lifelong
yes,
skill,
it
and
is.
It doesn't go away even if they don't use it.
That's
it's
what
there
right.
forever.
Right. And that's what we're getting at. We have our caller back here, and this is somebody in the 701 area code. I'm going to be turning on your mic, and you're going to be on the air. Please introduce yourself. You're free to be anonymous if you'd like, and be prepared to ask your question. You're on the air. Hello.
Hey. Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Hey.
Do you have a question
Hello?
For Tara?
Yeah. So my dad died 9/11, and they just finished building the Twin Towers. And mm-hmm. keep remembering them. Hello?
Yes, I'm here. So it sounds like you're calling in because you have a concern about remembering folks who did on 9/11?
Yeah.
You say your aunt died?
What? My dad.
Oh, your dad. Your dad died on 9/11. I'm
yeah.
very, very sorry
to
hear that.
It's been a while now, but they finished rebuilding the towers. He was one of the main people in there. You know what his name was?
Oh, sure.
Ohamed.
Mm-hmm.
Ohamed Akbar.
Oh, I see. Well,
yeah.
you know, I'm
yeah,
glad that you called.
He hit the tower pretty hard.
I'm glad that you called in to remind us of that. I know that the towers being built can bring a lot of memories back for folks, and you know that it's a time of completion whereby you know memories of your loved ones who perished you know will be raised again. It's a tough time, even though it's a time of celebration. You know that we have come to this point where. You know, it's a completion, it's a rebirth of sort. But for folks who lost family on 9/11, it can bring back different kinds of memories, and it can be a very tough time.
It can indeed. And mediation was actually one of the processes that they used in trying to figure out how to rebuild the towers and how they use different types of processes to hear from all the different parties that were concerned. Which is one of the reasons that it took a long time, that, you know, each type of process for dispute resolution has its pros and cons. And one of the things about mediation, as I said in the classroom, you know, it does take longer to sit down and say, hey, how do you feel? What happened? Can you tell me about it? What do you want to do to solve this? That takes longer than give another pencil, you know. So, but there's a long benefit that.
About the long-term benefit of having a mediated solution. That's absolutely key. And it's an amazing thing when folks go through mediation training, they understand that when people have a vested interest in the solution, when they are part of creating the solution, they're more likely to abide by the agreement
that
comes out of it. And then, yes, it does take longer to sit down and talk things through. However, when you get out into a situation where now you're turning to the court,
mm-hmm.
that can take a heck of a lot longer.
And be much more expensive,
exactly.
and the emotional toll for people staying in conflict. And that's one
right.
of the things I think when we talk about getting the message out to the public and
mm-hmm.
increasing public awareness, you know, we're taught, you were wrong, sue them, you know.
Yes.
Go to the courts, have your day in court. And, you know, I had an opportunity when I was first in law school. I had a situation where I was supposed to rent an apartment
mm-hmm.
and I drove up to New Hampshire, went to see the apartment, and they said, nope, sorry, we're not going to rent to you.
Hmm.
And without going into all the details of it,
mm-hmm.
I ended up bringing them to court over the case, a small claims case.
Mm-hmm.
And at the courthouse, they said, well, would you like to mediate? And I was just starting to take my very first course on mediation and intro to ADR kind of thing. And I said, no. I said, I'm right.
How interesting.
I'm a lawyer. Right. I want to be able to present my case.
You're going into ADR.
Even though, well, I would take my first class in it.
Okay.
I'd had like, you know, a month and a half of classes and learning what the concept was. And it was my school that actually ran that program.
Hmm.
And yet I still said, but I'm right. I don't lose my mother. And I tell kids, my students that experience as well, because it, in retrospect, what ended up happening was I was stunned.
Yeah.
I said, but there's all other factors that go into the process there,
right,
and
right.
the anguish that he waited for. But the lesson and the words was, you know, if I would have tried mediation and I wasn't happy, I could work anything. And so you really, that's such a great message, I think, is that you really, by trying this, you don't really have much to lose. You know, what you share in mediation is protected. And if it doesn't work, you can always go to mediation. You can always try arbitration. You can try other kinds of, you can appeal to the authority. You know, even in a school, if you don't like what happened in mediation, go to the principal, go to the teacher. That's fine. But if you look at percentages, they say overall, approximately 85% of mediated agreements are followed through because, as you said, there's the ownership, the buy-in, whereas people who go to court, and it could take years to do that, and money and anguish and all of that, health problems are caused, all this kind of stuff. But only even getting to that point, very often it's the lawyers who do the talking.
Mm-hmm.
You don't actually get to say anything a lot of the time. And only 60% of those court decrees, even when the judge says, yes, you are right, that person must pay you, only 60%
because
of the time that actually happened. Well, you can't get blood from a stone. So it kind of, it really, you know, mediation, the people who go through mediation at all levels, whether it's a, you know, or a family business or any other, a divorce situation, any of these cases, the vast majority are so satisfied with the process, even if they don't come to a complete solution. Their satisfaction is so much better. They understand better. More in control of themselves, they've understood the other side to some extent, even if not completely. So it's been proven to be a very successful way of solving conflict.
Well, one of the things is that in the beginning situation, the emotional impact on you really is not at issue. It's not relevant to the case. You know, legal processes are mainly about material issues. You know, you have to show damages, and your damages have to be, you know, monetizable or in other ways, you know, made in a way that's concrete, so the judge has something to divide.
The judge
can't divide your feelings.
Right. Well, I always remember from my law school days the concept of stare decisis.
Yes.
Where you know, cases are decided based on how cases went before them.
Exactly.
And in mediation, it never made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Only in very rare cases, in my opinion, does that make sense, where you really have to set a precedent. You really have to take a stand and show this is wrong for this reason. Those kind of cases, I think, should go to court where other people are going to follow this example on a big level. But most cases, it's about the two people or the 10 people or whoever it is that's actually involved in that particular situation. And when you do agreement writing and generating solutions, we do lots of great activities that show you can have lots of different solutions to the same problem. And we talk to the kids about, you know, you might have been in that same situation before. You might have had the best idea. If they would just do this, it would work. But you know what? It's not about you. It's not you in that conflict. And what worked for you may or may not work for them. And by giving your own opinion, we teach the kids to be neutral. But by sticking yourself in there, you're interfering with their ability to solve it for themselves and be satisfied with the result. Because then if it doesn't work, you're the one in trouble because it was your idea. So we teach them the benefit is the ownership.
What a tremendous lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep thinking about the kinds of people we are growing up.
Yes, good key.
Right.
Good word.
Who's being put out into society. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that folks know how to reach you.
Yes.
So tell me a bit about your work, your business, and how folks can reach out.
Sure, thank you. Well, my business is Customized Training Solutions. And I do have a website, some videos on there as well, and that's tarafishler.com. It's TARAFISHLER, there's no C, .com, tarafishler.com, and you can email me, tara@tarafishler.com. And, you know, I do a free needs assessment with any new clients, just really what I like to emphasize is customized training and high quality training. I want to give individual clients what it is they're looking for. So while I have lots of workshops I've done on diversity, strategic planning, anti-bullying, mediation, all kinds of things. And I also want to mention special needs. That's a niche that I really like working with, is working with parents, students, teachers, assistant teachers on different kinds of special needs and understanding them and how to help kids in the classroom. One of my children also has some special needs. So it's a personal interest and specialty of mine. But I really want it to be about what people are looking for. So we will do a needs assessment. And so feel free to, you know, click on the website,
yes,
tarafishler.com, and I'd be happy to speak with you.
Right. Folks can get in touch. And also, folks can come to my blog, which is untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. And that's Untangled Resolutions with a D, Untangled with a D, and all in one word. And get links as well to the website if you'd like to do it that way. And I'm going to, of course, have you start up with Joe, so that that's available to you, and you can share it with other folks whom you think would benefit from listening to the show. And Tara, you have brought forth some amazing things. I was looking forward to our chat together based on what we talked about beforehand and so forth. But now that I've heard exactly what it is that you're doing and, you know, some of the stories that are coming out from the classrooms that you work in, I'm just absolutely delighted. I can't tell you.
Thank you. I'm so glad I could be here, yeah, and speak with you, you know, about the work that I do. And I have to say, I always try and teach my own children that they should do what they're passionate about. They,
right,
should do what they love,
yeah,
and make enough money that they can live the lifestyle they want to live. Mm-hmm. But really, I'm very fortunate to be able to create a line of work that I am passionate about, that I enjoy doing, that I can set my schedule, and I love being with the people, you know, and I love working with the kids and the interest that they bring. I also love working with teachers because, mm-hmm, I feel that, you know, if I'm teaching a skill to them, they're going to pass that on and on and on and on. And so when I think about the ripple effect of teaching, I get very excited about,
yeah,
that too.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I am as well. And if you don't mind,
sure,
you have your love for children, your ability to work, mm-hmm, with them, and then also there's the sense of adventure that it takes to be an entrepreneur. And it looks as though you've combined those and combined that with your family. So you have a very interesting and amazing story regarding,
yes,
your family. Tell me a,
yes,
little bit
I
about
do
that.
Well, I have 4 children. Two are biological and 2 are newly adopted. So we
how
have,
newly?
3 months,
yes,
now, just over 3 months.
Oh my goodness!
They're from Ukraine, so my children range in age from 7 to 13. And, you know, we're trying out, and I will mention the conflict resolution skills. When I do parent workshops, I always give the caveat that I don't have a perfect family. I don't run, you know, everything tip top, you know, I'm human too, like everybody else, but we do try to use the techniques that I know. You know, we will sometimes have a family meeting. I will try to paraphrase what I'm hearing. I do try to practice active listening, you know, give an eye message, things like that, as much as I can. It's also hard to do that when you're in the middle, but I try my best to be able to incorporate
those
things. Well,
you know, we're running down to the
yes,
last few minutes of the show, but I do want to ask you about that because that's something,
sure,
that's kind of funny, that I think that mediators and people who are in conflict resolution, conflict management, dispute,
mm-hmm,
resolution run into. Sometimes it drives my family nuts.
Yeah, you're doing that thing on me.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah,
my,
exactly, exactly. Are you doing that counseling thing?
Well, the nice thing, that was one of the best parts about training my son Jordan in,
yeah,
what I do, because now I can explain to him and I can use the references from our training. Remember in Heart Story when the person had that really bad day and how they reacted and how other people, so I can use that and he gets it,
yeah,
in a way that other people don't understand.
Right,
so once,
right,
you've gone through the training, you really can appreciate things in a different,
yeah,
way,
yeah,
I think.
Oh, it's absolutely. I have done it with my own family in terms of, you know, having a conversation. I remember specifically one with my father,
mm-hmm,
where, you know, I was able to step back in the middle of the conversation and say to myself, wait a minute, you've got training,
uh-huh,
in this situation. Use your training.
That's hard to do, but you got to do
it. Use your training, right.
I try to approach conversations that way as well, as,
yeah,
much as I can, to try and take yourself out of the moment. And sometimes I'm more successful than,
sure,
others.
Sure.
But really, to be able to think back and, okay, you know, what would be the best way of approaching this?
Right.
I do that not just with my family,
right,
but in other relationships as well. And,
right,
and I one of the things I like, you know, I serve on the NYSDA board, New York yeah. State Dispute Resolution Association, as president-elect. And,
congratulations.
You know, thank you. And I really like that the board is able, for the most part, to walk the talk. I've been on other boards where that's not always the case.
Yeah.
And they're really, you know, when there's conflicts, there's right. always going to be conflicts.
Right.
We know in our work it exists. But they're able to talk about things
right.
in a reasonable way right. and come to a reasonable resolution.
I remember in my work as a office, I was worked with Marsha Wagner, who is just marvelous and very well known in the field. And
yes.
we once had somebody coming in, and we were having a discussion as to whether we were going to go forward with the program. So this young woman is sitting in the office listening to us talk, and her eyes are as big as saucers. And at the end of the conversation, she's like, "Oh my gosh, I've never heard." You know, this, am I getting that right? And yeah, well, no, actually, it's this. And she said, "You know, I've not heard people talking this way. This is amazing."
Mm-hmm.
And as I was saying, I did that with my dad. I said to him, I said, "Dad, I don't feel like I'm being heard."
Mm-hmm.
And to his credit, he stopped and said, "Okay, well, you know, talk to me about that." And I said, "It would be helpful to me if you would paraphrase me."
Mm-hmm.
And this is what paraphrasing is.
Yep, that's right.
And so we practiced paraphrasing, and then we went back into the conversation, and I said, and he paraphrased me, and it was an amazing
thing.
Right.
It really worked,
exactly.
You know?
The conversation totally changed.
Absolutely. It makes a big difference.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
those are the skills that stay with the kids forever.
Right. Yeah.
You know, whether they can call upon it. They may not know that they're even doing it.
Right.
You know, but it gets into their brain
right.
and it stays there
right.
and it hopefully makes them great people.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, wonderful. Tara, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to have you here on the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Yes. And we're going to be having another show next week. If you'd like to see updates about that, visit the blog, untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. And I believe next week, Eileen Rowley is going to be on the show. So look forward to having you back as a guest and listener, and we welcome you to call in and talk and ask questions. I'm going to leave you now with a piece by Brandon Ross. It is called Race Face, and it is from his album Costume. And I will always say this with the show, we support independent musicians. We encourage folks to go and buy the music, pay for the music. They work really hard, and this is how they make their living, and so we ought to support that. So you can go to iTunes, and the album, again, is called Costume. The artist is Brandon Ross, and the piece is called Race Face. Have a wonderful week, everyone. We'll talk to you again next week. Thank you.